Starting around the year 2000, radio stations began streaming their broadcasts online. The term podcasting, named after the iPod, appeared in 2004. In those early days, a slew of new shows popped up, and some of them have stuck around. The online magazine Slate launched a current affairs talk show called Political Gabfest in 2005, still going strong. Emily Bazelon's one of the hosts. She's also an investigative journalist and staff writer for The New York Times Magazine. Raymond Tungekar sat down with her to ask how the Gabfest got started.
The Gabfest has pretty humble origins. Andy Bowers, who's the guru of all Slate podcasts and a former NPR guy, had the idea of a show with maybe a rotating cast of characters that would be the equivalent of what political pundits would talk about in the bar after the real show on TV. And so originally when it started, John and David and I weren't the regulars. It was a bunch of different people. And then it just turned out the three of us would walk to get lunch together a lot. And we just developed this kind of natural way of shooting around ideas. And eventually that translated into the studio. Although I have to say, we listened to the very first episode we did together the other day, and it was terrible.
Huh, how come?
Well, we were super stiff.
So do you find yourself actually having to, like, I mean, the thing is, you have like a wonderful rapport with John and David. I also wonder how much of that is kind of acting.
It's not acting. I mean, I think what we learned, if anything, from listening to that first episode was that when we were trying to kind of play the role of like real people who know what they're talking about, it was pretty disastrous. I sounded so humorless. And you could hear David kind of reaching for a certain phrase a little bit. And then we just like relaxed and treated being in the studio the same way we treat just having conversations with each other. It's very fluid. It never feels to me like it's really very different. And I think that's why the show works.
Jeb Bush kind of sort of announced something this week. What was it, John?
He announced that he is actively going to think about having an exploratory committee. He's going to form a PAC.
He's raising money.
He's going to form a PAC to raise money.
And he's trying to shove other contenders for his fundraisers out of the way.
Right. Well,
or find out he's too unpopular among the base to ever win.
Right. So Emily's jumped ahead.
Why are you trying
story?
To jump ahead and condense the whole topic
into
like 35 seconds?
I was trying to see if John
seconds.
Thought I was right. Will gave me a big pat on the
here.
Head. Yeah. Will gave me a pat on the head in the last segment. I've gotten over eager. I'll now shut up. I'm sorry.
No. I was just trying to, like, so what he's formally done there, you know, the presidential announcement.
Well, I wonder how the transition worked out for you coming from, you know, a print reporting background. Was it difficult for you to start doing something in audio? You know, this type of informal discussion?
Yeah, it's definitely a different skill. I think that there's something about the informality and the freewheeling nature of it that's very addictive or like very appealing for a print person. You're not measuring every word. You can kind of play around with ideas. And I've definitely let myself do that. And once in a while, I'll either say something that's totally stupid, or I'll say it in a way that is completely stupid and basically make a fool of myself. And someone will call me on it. And I'll think like, oh, yeah, I really should have thought that through first. But honestly, if I corrected for all those bad moments, I don't think the show would be very good because I would be weighing every word. And I think for all of us, the way in which we feel free to pose questions and think things through and not be held to a standard of this is my absolutely most informed opinion, I think it's actually important that we don't hold ourselves to that standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a level of forgiveness, I think, from the audience. It's interesting. You know, I mean this in the best way possible, but the Gabfest format is kind of an old idea. You know, it's just like three people talking into a microphone and sharing ideas. You know, it's the type of thing that talk radio has been doing for years. And yet, the Political Gabfest is one of the most successful podcasts out there. Hundreds of thousands of listeners, 75,000 subscribers. Why do you think it's been so successful?
I have no idea. I mean, it's so nice of you to say that. I don't think any of us really know the answer to that. It has something to do, I guess, with the rapport among the three of us. Maybe it's just that we started like almost 10 years ago. We've really been doing this for a long time. Maybe we just sort of snuck into this space before a lot of other people were podcasting.
I also wonder if it's about the podcast's ability to get in the hands of a very niche audience.
Absolutely. I mean, there is an intimacy about audio, right? It's really true for how a lot of us think about our favorite NPR hosts. You feel like you've had dinner with them a million times, even though you have never met them. So I think that intimacy is really important. And then I think you're also right. Podcasts do not have to have a huge audience in like TV or even radio terms to be successes.
Mm-hmm. And one other question I have about just, it seems like with the Gabfest and a lot of other podcasts, there's a level of ownership that audience members have on it. Like they can actually see, for example, with Serial, you know, you can actually see the reporting happen. It's, you feel like you're part of the whole process. I wonder if podcasts and the Gabfest makes journalism both accessible and kind of humanizes it.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, one of the revelations of Serial, because I've been just completely enjoying the success of Serial and listening it to myself, but one of the revelations is that someone could actually be interested in your reporting process. As someone who does long-form magazine work, that's really reassuring.
Okay. Well, can you just walk me through like the whole process of putting a show together? Who comes up with the topics, for example?
Usually by Tuesday, David will send around an email proposing a few topics, and John and I will weigh in. Sometimes we say no, we don't like any of those. Sometimes there's no clear news in a week, and we're all sort of fishing around and looking for something. Hopefully by Wednesday, we've solidified things, and we have an amazing intern, and he has been doing these great prep memos for us. So then by Wednesday night, we have like 40 pages to read about the three stories we're going to talk about. And then sometimes, you know, news will break at the last minute. We'll just switch on a Thursday morning to something else and not be super prepared, but try to really just like jump on the news and bounce off it.
Hmm. Well, what's an example of a topic that's too obvious that you had to, you know, just reconsider?
Dispatch. Let's see. Well, like, so this week we were considering whether to talk about the hostage-taking situation in Australia. And if that was unfolding over a longer period of time and we could talk about the media coverage of it or some other part of it, then that might have been interesting to us. But it's so clear this is awful and the terrorists are horrible. There's just, it's not clear what the second or third sentence is or like how to mix it up. So that's the kind of topic that we might stay away from. I think we will stay away from that this week.
When you're coming up with a topic, is there ever a point where you think to yourself, this wouldn't really work for the Gabfest, I might just write about it for the New York Times instead? What types of topics lend itself towards audio versus print?
That's a good question. We do sometimes pull topics out because they just seem like they wouldn't be conversations. Like a Supreme Court case might be interesting to me, and then I'll realize in trying to sell David and John on it that it's just too in the weeds. The truth is that if I figure that out, it's probably not a good thing for me to write about anyway, but I might be stubborn and try to find some way into it in print on my own without them.
Well, I also, you know, there's been a lot of articles, especially on Slate, about how we're entering some kind of podcast renaissance. Is there a part of you that's like, I've been doing this for years?
Me? Oh, no. I'm so happy about the podcast renaissance. I mean, look, for many years, and it still happens frequently, I mention the Gabfest and people have no idea what I'm talking about. And I say, oh, you know, it's this podcast. And they still don't even know that word. So then I say, well, it's like an internet radio show. It's like radio, but you can download it and listen to whatever you want. And then maybe I get nods of recognition like, oh, that sounds like not a terrible idea. But it's still not super mainstream. And so it's good for podcasting to have a bigger audience. I mean, Serial is like the best thing that happened to all of us, I would argue, for that reason. And I also am just such a fan of this medium myself that the more it takes off, like the better for me, the more great things there are to listen to.
Okay. Well, and also, last question I have to ask. Are podcasts going to kill public radio?
So what do you think about that?
I think there's going to be a period of change. Different stations will have to play around with different funding models. But I think there always will be a place for some kind of terrestrial radio-based news content.
Yeah. So I love my local NPR station and wish it only well. Here's my thing, though. I notice now that when I'm in the car and so I will turn on NPR and I'll start listening to Morning Edition or All Things Considered. But now I have my phone or my iPod with me. And if I get bored immediately, I just put in a podcast. I'm someone who's addicted to storytelling, and I love the cast of characters of the shows that I follow. And that just has more appeal to me a lot of times than listening to whatever the news report might or might not yield. So maybe this is bad for public radio. On the other hand, a lot of the best shows are coming straight from public radio. So I guess the question is, what's the financial model that will allow more of those shows to be produced without screwing things up for the local stations? But I hope there's a way to strike a balance there.
I wonder if at the same time, I mean, from a news perspective, will that type of control that audiences have, will that make it more likely that important stories that need to be out there will be overlooked?
Maybe. I mean, this is a question we're asking generally about the media, right? Whether it's become so fragmented. And so, yes, we have lost the moment, that supposed golden era where there were three networks on television and they dictated the news and big stories supposedly got their due. It seems to me that there's a lot to be said for just like lots of different flowers blooming and people picking what they want to hear. And, you know, on the internet, when a story is really, really good and interesting and original, it takes off. And it feels like, in a very democratic way, everybody hears it or reads it. Maybe it was produced by an outlet you've never heard of before. And yet you'll hear about it because someone will send it over Facebook or they'll tweet it at you, or you'll just hear other people talking about it and you'll go find it yourself. So I guess that's the like rosier view of what you're talking about. And I don't know which is more right. Probably they're both somewhat true.
That's one of the hosts of Slate's Political Gabfest, Emily Bazelon. She's also a New York Times Magazine writer. Raymond Tungekar talked with her.